from the high desert and the great American Southwest. I bid you all good evening, good morning, good afternoon, wherever you may be in the world. Every single inch of it covered one way or the other by this program, Midnight in the Desert. I'm Art Bell. Great to be here. I had a surprise for you tonight, but it got blown by social media. That's all right. My guest tonight in a bit is going to be Travis Walton. Abductee. Not alleged abductee, as it says on Wiki, but abductee. The real deal, folks. Two rules for my show. No bad language. No bad language. And only one call per show. That's the rules. The thank yous are Telos for the great sound. It is astounding what this Telos gear does. Keith Rowland, my webmaster, my producer, Heather Wade. Tell you more about her in a moment. All of you, of course, the Bell Gab website. Check them out yet. They're mean. Well, they think they're mean. Slightly lovable, mostly mean. If you can handle it. People who love our Bell, midnightindesert.com, all chat sites. And Stream Guys, of course, who get it all to you, LV.net, who gets it from here to Stream Guys, and then Peter Eberhardt, our sales guy. And you know, I've been forgetting Leo, our newsman, who does an incredible job, no question about it. All right, real quick in the news, Trump says Fox was mean to him. Mean. And I thought they were too, actually. A French search plane is lifting off, looking for more debris near Reunion. Nothing officially spotted as of yet. And then this item. Hi, Art. Email. First, welcome back to the airwaves, podcast, late night radio and all that. Great to hear you again. This photo I took in the winter of 2007. I took it right after it snowed here in Everett, Washington. It was around midnight or so. My back deck looking northwest toward Port Gardner Bay, which is part of Puget Sound. There is a neighbor's house in the background, and there appears to be a ghost image, a pretty awful one, I might add, near the back edge of the deck, and it seems to be looking at me. Now, I didn't see it at the time of the photo, or the photo would not exist. I would have been heading indoors at a quick pace, locking the doors behind me. Hope you find it of interest. Boy, I sure do, Ron. Thank you very much. It's on artbell.com. If you want to go up and take a look, this thing is creepy by any measure. One of the better either ghost photographs or creature photographs I've ever seen in my life. So artbell.com. All right, so in a moment, Travis Walton. I looked him up on Wiki. I've interviewed Travis probably 6 or 10 years ago or something. Travis, Wiki says, is an American logger who was allegedly, and I scratched that word out, who was abducted by a UFO, on November 5th, 1975, after working with a logging crew in the Apache National Forest in Arizona. Walton could not be found, but in fact reappeared after a 5-day intensive search. The case received mainstream publicity, remains one of the best-known instances of alien abduction. Again, I went right past alleged. UFO historian Jerome Clark writes that few abduction reports have generated as much controversy as the Walton case. It was made, you know, into a movie, a very, very popular movie called Fire in the Sky. And prior to doing tonight's interview, I again watched Fire in the Sky with my wife, who was utterly freaked out, completely freaked out. And so I imagine she is sitting intently listening to this interview. So what's going to happen is, coming up in a moment, the real McCoy. That's what he is, the real McCoy, Travis Walton. Stay right where you are. These interviews are few and far between. This is Midnight in the Desert, and I'm Art Bell, as usual, raging in the nighttime.
Painted I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder. One of the four beasts saying, come and see. And I saw, and behold, a white horse.
There's a man going round taking names, and he decides who to free and who to blame. Everybody won't be treated all the same. There'll be a golden ladder reaching down when the man comes around. The hairs on your arm will stand up at the terror in each sip and in each sup. Will you partake of that last offered cup or disappear into the potter's ground?
Feel free to sniff our packets. Then, with a smile on your face, please call the show at 1-952-225-5278. That's 1-952-CALL-ART.
Good evening, everybody. Here he is from Snowflake, Arizona. Actually, the place he always was, really, Travis Walton. Travis, hi.
Good evening.
Good evening. It has been, I don't know, 6 years, 10 years, like forever since we have had an opportunity to talk. So
yes.
It's really an honor to have you back, and I was serious about scratching out that alleged stuff. What happened to you happened, period. That's it.
Absolutely. I mean, we're at the tipping point. Back in the day, they used to say, anybody who believes in such things is a kook. Now we're actually coming to the point where the debunkers and the skeptics are the kooks. Because the definition of a kook is someone who believes things that are at odds with known facts and accepted beliefs.
Thank you.
And that's them, not us.
That's right. That is them, and there is so much to prove it now. And I really hate taking you back to this story again, but that's what I have to do because they'd crucify me otherwise. You're still married, right, to Mike Rogers' sister?
Yeah, but we've been separated a number of years, amicably, but definitely living apart.
Okay.
November 5th, 1975, you know, in some ways, it's like yesterday. You know, it seems, you know, the emotional impact in particular, but the memories are so fresh, it's hard to believe it's been nearly 40 years.
Travis, but, you know, has this thing defined your life ever since? I mean, I can't imagine that it hasn't. It's kind of defined your life.
Yeah, it has, you know. Actually, you know, I have to say regrettably that, you know, It's something I live with every day. But the negative aspect of it has shifted. And, you know, that might be surprising. I stuck it out here in Snowflake, and it used to be, you know, people would look and whisper and point.
Yep.
But now, you know, the local people come up, shake my hand, and or greet me openly, and they'll say, you know, I always supported you. And I'm thinking, well, I wish you'd have spoke up a long time
back,
ago.
Back then.
No. But it is good, you know, that almost every time I go out now, I get some kind of positive response. And I'll tell you what, we've come a long ways in this town.
Oh, yes. How big a town now is Snowflake?
Well, it was about 3,500 then, but I don't know, not a whole lot bigger. Might be 5,000.
Okay. All right.
We have added a stoplight. We've added a McDonald's. So
oh, you have a stoplight and a McDonald's.
Yeah.
Wow. So, we celebrated here in Pahrump, Nevada. We got our first stoplight and our first McDonald's, so I know how you feel. All right. So your crew consisted of Mike Rogers. Let's see.
Jim Peterson.
Jim Peterson, right. Is Ken Peterson or?
Ken Peterson.
Okay.
Kenneth Peterson.
Right. John Gillette.
John Gillette, Dwayne Smith, who always gets confused with my brother, Dwayne. It's a different spelling of Dwayne. But, and then there was Steve Pierce and Alan Dallas.
Okay. I'm going to go to the movie for this, and I know the movie probably got an awful lot of stuff wrong, but there's something I want to ask about, and that is, well, you know what? I shouldn't ask about that yet. It tell the story as I suppose Mike might have told it that night. The movie, is it close enough for comfort, or is it far away from what actually occurred?
Well, you know, anytime Hollywood tells a real-life story, they've got to simplify and abbreviate and sort of symbolize things, because you're telling in 90 minutes something that spanned years.
Right.
So some of that is to be expected and is acceptable. I had two brothers, Don and Dwayne, who became one named Dan. James Garner was several investigators and lawmen rolled into one, and they actually reduced the number of the crew from 7 to 6. And, you know, some of that's acceptable and, you know, understandable. But the greatest amount of changes were what happened aboard the craft. And I see no reason for that except commercial conditions.
All right. Well, we'll get to that. But all of this crew, you were up there cutting and clearing for, I guess, what, the U.S. Forest Service?
Yeah, it was a government contract to clear out undergrowth, damaged trees, and diseased trees, and, you know, generally clean up the forest, and also a lot of fuel reduction, which is, you know, fire reduction strips through the area that makes it easier to fight forest fires that might spring up.
It's hard work, huh?
Oh, it's definitely some of the hardest work you can do, and at high altitude on steep terrain and carrying a heavy chainsaw all day. It's definitely not for the faint of heart.
Mm-hmm. It's for the young. And by the way, you are quite a bit older than you were then. How old were you at the time? You were 22, I guess?
I was 22, and now I'm 62.
Oh, my God. I'm 70, Travis, so there you go. Wow, you're over 60 now. Holy mackerel.
Incredible. I don't feel that.
Oh, I could
still outrun my boys.
I don't feel it either at all, but it happens, and those years go by. So you guys were, you know, it started out with you, everybody in the truck going up there and working, and I guess that you were on your way home. It was dark, and if the movie is accurate, somebody saw something in the distance that, and I guess you were part of this, that they claimed looked at first like fire.
Yeah, it was a glow, and, you know, we tried out a number of ideas of what it might be, you know, deer hunters camped out there, a plane crash, you know, a fire in the tree, but nothing was fitting in with what we were seeing.
Right. It was a full glow in the sky, kind of like in the movie, maybe not as reddish, but a full glow,
right.
You know. And the sun had gone down, of course, in the west, so it could not have been the sun. It had to be a fire or, as you mentioned, a crash or something like that. Anyway, it was apparently pretty much directly ahead of where you were headed on that only road you were on to get out of there, right?
Right. And closer we got, I could see that there was a break in the trees ahead where the light was shining across the road. I said, Mike, hurry up and get up there and see what it is, because by then, you know, all of us had noticed it. And so we bounced along, went on up there. I mean, it was curious, but it wasn't all that alarming at first. But we burst into the clearing. Man, it was bam. It just hit us right between the eyes. It was unmistakable.
Mm-hmm.
Alan yelled out, "It's a flying saucer."
Oh, did he really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know that. But it obviously looked like one, certainly depicted in the movies. Did the movies have it about right the way it looked?
No, not at all.
Okay, good.
But, you know, it was definitely not some little glowing point of light off in the distance, like the skeptics tried to say it could have been the planet Jupiter. And this was less than 90 feet away, unmistakable metallic disc hovering there. You know, I threw open the door thinking it would just take off before I got 10 steps outside the truck. But the closer I got, the scareder everybody got.
Yeah, they all stayed in the truck, right?
Yeah.
And, in fact, they were screaming bloody murder at you to get the hell back.
Yeah, they were describing me in some rather uncomplimentary language that, to get back in the truck so we could get the heck away from there.
Okay.
And, I was scared, too, but I was trying not to show it. So, you know, the closer I got, the slower I went. And I could hear this sound that it was making. It was a bizarre combination of highs and lows. And
highs and lows. You mean pitched high, pitched low?
Pitched cyclic sort of a sound, and then a throbbing, real below bass sort of sound. It was a really complex. I gave a talk to an engineering school, and they were very interested in the types of sound that I was hearing because it would give clues about what might be driving this thing. But the closer I got, the scareder I got. And so when I got right up to it, I mean, I was awestruck, too. You know, later on...
Let me stop you and ask you, first of all, it's not your average person, Travis, that would get out of the truck and try to run under something like this. The average person would do what the guys in the truck did after, you know, something happened to you. They would take off like a bat out of hell. You know, I mean, that's scary. So can you remember in your mind what caused you to get out of the truck and try to get under this thing?
Well, that's what I was starting to say, is that Alan and Steve thought to them it looked like I was under outside control, that I was in some kind of trance. But, you know, I think we were all entranced, so to speak. It was just an incredible, awesome sight, and all the crewmen agree with that. And it was just wow, and plus the sound, and plus there was something in the air, just this feeling. You know, Mike said it seemed like something was about to happen, and I think that we were sensing this electrical charge that was building. But
Yes, humans can feel that.
Yeah, and you know, what was making the hair rise on the back of your neck wasn't just fear. It was something kind of like a huge static charge or something.
That's probably exactly what it was. You can get that same feeling. I've been under 500,000 volt lines, and you can actually get little shocks from touching the wet grass beneath it. And you could feel that in your whole body, kind of like that?
Yeah. And plus the vibration, it was subsonic and ultrasonic. You know, they said they could feel it in the vibrating from the metal of the truck, you know. But because, you know, Mike had turned the engine off because when everybody started exclaiming, he had to lean over to see what everybody was looking at. But when I got up to where I was looking up at about a 45-degree angle, it was just so astonishing. It was smooth as glass over the entire surface, but parts of it were glowing and parts of it were metallic. And it was giving off this glow at the same time you could see the surroundings reflected in the surface. You know, it's kind of like when you look at a television set and you can see, you know, from the window.
So it was reflective, not like a mirror, but somewhat reflective.
Yeah. And as I was looking up at it, those guys were, you know, pretty much in a panic, screaming at me to get back in the truck. And I decided to turn around and run. But it suddenly got louder and started to move. And so I just instinctively just jumped for cover. And there was a log in the middle of the clearing, part of this brush pile that was there. And so I jumped down behind it. And then, you know, immediately, you know, decided to run back to the truck. But when I stood up, my head and chest at that point became the closest point to that vehicle craft that it had been in that entire time. And that's with me. I just felt a shock. It felt like I'd been physically hit by a truck, but it also felt kind of like an electrical shock, sort of this numbing, sort of a paralyzing feeling. But that was something I believed just as I blacked out.
Okay, let me ask you a question, Travis. Are you on a portable phone?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I am on a cordless hardwired line.
Cordless hardware. Okay, good. I'm getting an occasional little breakup, but nothing big. Nothing big. It's fine. So you decided at the last minute, the heck with this, I'm going to run.
Yeah. And
again, different than the movie, right? It didn't show that in the movie. What it showed in the movie was you got thrown by this thing. So that was wrong.
That is what happened. That is what happened.
Oh, it is what happened.
I decided to run, but I didn't just standing up and zap. And there was, you know, the way it's depicted in the movie, the guy, the actor, is jerked and then was thrown back. But
right.
They kind of dragged that out. It was just a, you know, it's strange because Hollywood normally, you know, wants to put on a light show, and they really missed an opportunity there because it was far more violent than they depicted. It was so violent that it was compared, you know, by the crew that was watching to a grenade or a landmine throwing me through the air.
Wow.
Some guys said, you know, it threw me 10 feet. Some thought it was 20 feet. But John said that my body fell like a sack of meat, you know, like there were no bones in it. They said that no attempt to break my fall or anything, to the point where, I mean, the violence was so powerful that they immediately started screaming and it killed him.
Yeah, they were convinced you were dead. And frankly, even from watching the movie, I can understand that. They thought this thing had killed you. And, of course, at that point, if the movie is accurate, they said, heck with this, we're getting out of here, and went tearing down some of the rest of that road as fast as they could go. That
accurate? Yeah, nearly wrecking the truck. You know, I do not blame them. I always want to say that those guys did the right thing at that point. What was the point in risking everyone's lives to save somebody they thought was already dead?
Mm.
So anybody that thinks that was cowardly is just wrong. Mike, you know, had the safety of the crew, you know, under his responsibility. When they got up the road, they said that they argued about whether it had actually disintegrated or incinerated me. When they were unable to, you know, find some deer hunters, you know, with guns to come back, they decided they would come back. Now, in the movie, when Mike said, this truck's going back, anybody who doesn't want to can get out and wait here, nobody volunteered to stand alone in the dark like in the movie. They all said, no way, we're staying with the truck. So they all went back.
Okay, so, that's really a deviation. So every one of them went back. They didn't stand in the dark, as depicted in the movie. They all went back.
Well, yeah.
Bless their hearts.
I give them credit for that. That took courage.
Yeah, it sure did.
You know, like I was telling Steve today, courage is not the absence of fear. Courage is to keep going in the presence of fear.
Yes. All right, so when they got back there...
Kenny was saying the scariest thing to him, because I see they saw the craft leaving, scariest thing to him, he thought, would be what my charred body was going to look like laying there.
You say they saw it leave?
Yeah, as they approached the area, they saw it streak off.
Wow. And obviously they were immediately looking for you, and you were not there anymore. Now, was there any trace left on the ground of either you or the presence of that craft above?
Well, in long-term of ongoing research, there was evidence of the craft having been there. And when the sheriff brought in the tracking dogs from the state prison, they were unable to find the trail going anywhere beyond where my body fell in the middle of that clearing.
And, you know, before we get further with this story, because people are going to be going, oh, come on, when you get into the details, your entire crew was given a lie detector test. And if I have it right, in the first one, Dallas may have been a little unreadable because he was so freaked out, but everybody else passed the lie detector test. And then, moreover, they were later given a second lie detector test, and everybody passed.
Yeah. The second round, Alan Dallas up first because, obviously, he had walked out on his initial test. But this was with the same examiner. And Mike was retested. I took two more tests from the state police lie detector expert, which, you know, at the time that the six tests had been passed, the president of the American Polygraph Association said that although a polygraph on a single test is less than 100%, when you have that many people passing tests on the same issue, the odds are over 1,000,000 to 1 of there being any error.
Okay, Travis, hold on. You can relax for about 7. This is Midnight in the Desert, and I'm Art Bell. For Dark Matter News, I'm Leo Ashcraft. NASA's one-ton Curiosity rover landed on Mars 3 years ago this week. As the car-sized rover touched down on the Martian surface, it ushered in a new era of planetary exploration on Mars. But it was also the start of something else. Curiosity's sardonic Twitter alter ego, known as the Sarcastic Rover. The Sarcastic Rover parody Twitter account came into being on August 6, 2012. The night of the famous 7 minutes of terror landing that brought Curiosity to the Martian surface. Sarcastic Rover's brand of science-minded wit was apparent from the moment it arrived on Twitter. Sarcastic Rover acts like any of us would after being sent to Mars. It's kind of upset, a little lonely, and it wants to make fun of everything. The parody account resonated with people immediately. The account attracted some 7,000 followers during its first night online, according to Jason Philitrault, a screenwriter and the mind behind the Sarcastic Robot. Sarcastic Rover now has about 134,000 followers, 3 years into Curiosity's mission. One of our listeners, Ron, ran across a photo from the winter of 2007 that he says he took right after it snowed there in Everett, Washington. He says it was around midnight or so, and the photo was taken on his back deck, which is looking northwest towards Port Gardner Bay, which is part of the Puget Sound. You can just see the neighbor's house in the background. There appears to be a ghost image near the edge of the deck, and it seems to be looking at Ron. He says he didn't see it at the time the photo was snapped. Instead, Ron says he would be heading indoors at a quick pace and locking the door behind him. Take a look at the backyard ghost sent in from one of our listeners, Ron, at darkmatternews.com or artbell.com.
After last night's show on Bigfoot, we've had earthquakes, meteors, asteroids, UFOs, volcanic activity, and something has shaken loose. Earlier today, young Eric Waters had an experience that will change his life forever. Today, a Boone man trying to enjoy a little bit of time in the North Carolina mountains had a run-in with Sasquatch. His little doggy was able to chase it away. Due to some licensing issues on YouTube, we were not able to get the audio or the video for this. I am going to attempt to reenact today's video. No, Yippee! No, Yippee! No, no! No, no. Oh, okay. Oh, we're safe. That's about it. And while he was breathing heavy and saying, no, Zippy, off to the right seemed to be a humanoid beast, a little shorter than normal. Might have been maybe a teenage, younger Sasquatch or Sasquai or Sagittarius. The Yeti seemed to be crouched and crawling away to the right. Seemed a little shorter than most. Yeah, that's right. Height doesn't matter. Well, this little guy was moving pretty quick for your normal Sasquatch, but hey, maybe he had to go. When nature calls! We enhanced some of the audio using our spectrometer vocalizer by subtracting the first and second tracks. Here's what we found. It continues to haunt me. E-may, no-a, acation-vay. According to our Pig Latin specialist, he was saying that he was on vacation. Eric's memory of this is corroded and polluted by the horrible smell. He said it was somewhere between a dead, rotting flesh and the sweet, pungent smell of a freshly sprayed skunk. Bigfoot investigators and enthusiasts from all over the area have swarmed to this little North Carolina town. Hopefully we'll find out soon what they have. This is John G. with Dark Matter News.
Down to Georgia, he was looking for a soul to steal. He was in a bind because he was way behind and he was willing to make a deal. When he came across this young man sawing on a fiddle and playing it hot, and the devil jumped up on a hickory stump and said, boy, let me tell you what, I guess you didn't know it, but I'm a fiddle player too, and if you'd care to take a dare, I'll make a bet with you. Now you play pretty good fiddle, boy, but give the devil his due. I bet a fiddle of gold against your soul because I think I'm better than you.
To reach midnight in the desert via Skype worldwide, if on a computer, please be sure to use a headphone mic and call MITD 51. That's MITD 51.
All right, everybody. Travis Walton is here. A very rare interview. And I'm trying to cover as many details as I can and see where the movie separates from the truth and what the truth really is. This is a real story, as I mentioned before the break. Everybody involved took multiple lie detector tests, and so this, you know, it's a real thing. Listen on, I guess, at your own peril if this kind of thing scares you, and it scares me.
As of now, there are 16 past tests. I've passed 5 different tests with 3 different examiners with extensive years in law enforcement, which is considered the better, more qualified polygraph examiner.
Even in the movie, you know, the guy came out and said, look, the truth is these guys were telling the truth, in my opinion. So
yeah, and, you know, the examiners stand by it to this day.
All right. So we're going to get back to what happened to you in the craft, but the whole town went to buzzing as you were gone, and you were gone for a total of 5 days. My God, that's a long time. They had dogs out. They had people out combing. They had helicopters up. They looked for you everywhere, and, of course, they began to suspect your crew of your possible, well, murder or something.
Murder.
Right? And And they became kind of unpopular in that small town. Are you still friends with Mike, by the way?
I haven't spoken to him in quite some time. He's kind of, you know, threw up his hands and didn't want to talk about this anymore. But
I do understand. How about the rest of them?
I'm going to have a couple of them come and speak at my conference, which we'll get to. And I'd like to get Mike to come, too, but, you know, his health's not what it used to be.
I do understand. All right. Back to the movie for a second. One thing they never explained in the interviewing they were doing, you know, as they thought you might have been murdered, they spoke to Alan Dallas. Now, it was referred in the movie or referenced in the movie that Dallas, he was kind of a, I don't know, what words would you use to describe?
The black sheep of the crew. Yeah, he had had some trouble with the law, and he was just generally, you know, had a few run-ins with various guys on the crew, and he and I had done a little sparring, and
yeah, he didn't much like you, I guess, huh?
Well, I there was a little bit of antagonism over some things, you know. It was a girl that he had been approached, that I had been dating. This was before my wife. But and then he and Mike got in a fist fight in the street in front of my house. And so, you know, it was just his nature. But the day of this incident, he had dropped a tree nearly on me, and that's what led to all this problem with the polygraph. You know, did he have any bad intentions towards
me? I see. That's why it came out a little screwy.
Yeah, because he was pretty sure that they were going to try to pin the murder on him.
Well, it looked like they might try pretty hard for a while there. What they never explained, and Alan admitted that there had been, Alan Dallas admitted there had been an altercation with you. Now, was he referring to the tree? Because he had a pretty nasty cut on his hand. And they never explained that.
We get scratched up at work all the time, you know. And after I was returned, the doctor examining me found a puncture on my arm, and you know, it was assumed that happened during my abduction, but it could have easily been, you know, being poked by a thorn in the course of a work day, you know.
Well, the one on Dallas looked really, in the movie, looked really serious, like, you know, he touched a chainsaw or something. Did you have a fight with him? You know,
not with chainsaws. I mean, you know, he nearly dropped the tree on me, and I gave him a, you know, a dirty look and said some things under my breath if he could read lips. I, you know, it wasn't a friendly exchange there, but...
But not physical?
Not normal. I mean, a rough bunch of guys.
Oh, yeah, of course. Know. Alpha males, all of you. Was there an actual physical altercation with him?
When he tried a spin kick on me, Steve... The youngest guy in the crew laughs about how Alan fell on his behind trying to do that, you know. It was just semi-good-natured sparring, you know.
Okay. All right. So no altercation that would have produced a cut like they showed?
No.
All right. Now back to you, Travis. And you were, while the whole town is going nuts and they're searching for you for all these days, you're suddenly in, well, where?
Well, I woke up on board the craft. I didn't know where I was at first, but I was in a lot of pain. And I was in and out for a while. And when I finally did come to, it was in a foggy, hazy kind of way. My vision was blurred and even double vision, and I it even hurt the light. Even though it wasn't bright, it hurt my eyes, and the pain in my head and chest was incredible. And I felt it was life threatening. You know, something was terribly wrong inside.
Describe your environment if you can when you woke up. Can you? I mean, when you looked around, what do you see?
It was dimly lit, and I could hear the sounds of movement around me. And I could just barely make out the forms of what I thought were doctors, but then my vision cleared and I could see these aliens standing close. And it just completely freaked me out. I mean, I was already scared about the way I felt, but I just completely lost my mind with fear.
Were you, describe what you were on, if you can. Were you on a slat?
I was lying on my back, and I was close enough to the ceiling before I even looked over and saw them. I figured I was on some kind of a gurney or a raised operating table, and I thought, you know, that I'd been hurt somehow and taken to the hospital.
Uh-huh.
But then when I finally focused on what I thought were medical people, it was these aliens, and I just flipped out.
Okay.
You know, a lot of people think, oh, I would stay calm, ask good questions.
Who thinks that? Not me.
You know, but you have to understand that, you know, the pain I was feeling, the feeling of something mortally wrong inside, but moreover, the most important feeling was that I felt like I couldn't get enough air, the feeling of suffocation. There's a scene in the movie of a membrane.
Yes.
When the actor's laying on the table and aliens are surrounding him, mm-hmm. and he's struggling to scream through this membrane, struggling to breathe through it. That didn't actually happen, but I think in that case, it does a better job of explaining the source of my panic, or at least the chief source, that, you know, that feeling of suffocation combined with the feeling of weakness, like you can't move when you need to move quickly. To get away. And so, you know, the suddenly realizing where I was gave me a shot of adrenaline, enough, a burst of strength to actually sort of lash out at them. It was, you know, pretty weak. And it was more of a push than a hit. And I rolled away in the opposite direction. This device they had lying across my chest fell off and hit the floor, but I just mainly kept my eyes on them as I backed away or stumbled backwards. And when I bumped up against this shelf behind me, I just looked real quick to see what I'd run into, and there was some things there, and I just grabbed the biggest thing there and started flailing in their direction, and that stopped their approach.
All right, two things to ask. One, the movie depicted a lack of gravity. You said something fell and hit the floor, so obviously there was some gravity.
Yeah, there was gravity. There was no weightlessness.
Okay.
And is actually, if anything, it might have been slightly heavy gravity.
Really?
To explain that feeling of weakness, although just the feeling of injury. I really think that whatever happened with that blast of energy from the craft, it did so much damage that when I came to at that point, whatever efforts had been made to revive me were not complete.
All right. You describe aliens very close to you, and of course everybody would like to know, forget the movie, what did these... Were these creatures all similar, or can you describe?
Yeah, they were very similar.
Okay.
And you do have to forget the movie because they changed them. The panic that the people at Paramount had was that these aliens had been in another production immediately prior to the production, filming of Fire in the Sky.
Right.
And they did not want anybody, you know, seeing something that had been seen before. So they changed their appearance, but they were what's, you know, back in then they didn't have the term grays, but that's what people call these small, hairless, grayish-white beings with huge eyes.
And
you know?
That is what you saw?
Yeah.
So that part of it, there's a classic gray that you just described. Hairless, pretty small generally. Any idea how tall they were?
Shorter than 4 feet, for sure.
So small.
But, you know, I really don't use the term gray. I don't like that. I think that there's probably a number of similar species that are just being stuck under one name that really are come from really different places. And I have, a whole line of reasoning that tells me that that's the case. The variations in descriptions that you see, and also there are a number of species of animals on the Earth that look very similar but are completely genetically unrelated. They just look similar because they live in a similar environment. And that's what I think is the case with these...
whatever they are?
Yeah.
So you pushed one I guess, pretty hard. Did he go reeling backward or what?
Yeah, it was softer and lighter than I expected, but it fell back pretty easily. And it was probably partly because it was totally unexpected. I think they were trying to maintain control of me, and it took me many years to figure out that it was probably some kind of neurological impairment due to this blast of energy from that craft that actually worked against their normal method of being able to control humans and keep them in some kind of trance or in a unconscious state. And that's why when they came around and I started flailing at them and they stopped and stared at me, that I felt that stare was so excruciating. That was my nightmares for months after the incident, that stare gave me this horrible feeling in my head. And in support of that was the EEG that I was given immediately afterwards that showed there was some kind of anomalous pattern that, I think is consistent with, some kind of burst of energy hitting me in the head.
Wow. Did they ever get control of you?
No, they were unable to get control of me, and I was thinking of fighting my way past them when they abruptly turned and left the room. They may have anticipated my move or just given up on... I mean, if the three of them combining their forces couldn't control me, they were going to have to go to Plan B of some kind.
Plan B. All right. Can you describe the room you were in?
It was very small, dimly lit, cramped. Not at all like depicted in the movie. It was not organic looking. It was not cluttered. Very featureless, metallic surfaces. I saw no writing or symbols, but, they may see in a broader spectrum of light than we do, and there may have been something
that you didn't see. Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, they left and went down a passageway to the right. So I went out and went to the left, fearing that they would come back.
Of course.
Looking for a way out, just in a blind panic to just open a door, and in my back of my mind thinking, just drop to the ground, be back in the woods.
Drop to the ground.
thinking that it was the craft was still in the woods.
That could have been acceleration that you were feeling that would make you feel heavier. At this point, you couldn't even really know if you were still in the atmosphere of the Earth or way past.
Yeah, in hindsight, it would have been foolish to get a door open, but that was my goal. And so I was afraid because the passage was so narrow and so cramped and turned so tightly that I couldn't see very far behind me to see if they were chasing me, and I couldn't see very far ahead of me to what was I, coming to.
Actually, so, I can see why you would think that. You might even think that you were still hovering not all that far above the forest floor. So, yeah, of course. That makes sense. That you would look for a door.
I went into this room where there were other doors leading out of it, which later piecing together the floor plan wouldn't have led to the outside, but I thought at that point that was my best bet of escaping this place.
Makes sense to me.
And so I pushed buttons and things trying to open the door unsuccessfully, and it did cause this... star pattern projection to move at one point.
What do you mean?
And
what star pattern?
There was this room was darkened and had points of light. Now, whether it was a planetarium-like projection or some viewing method of where it was actually at in real time, I don't know. But, it was very disorienting to have this pattern move.
Isn't that interesting? I don't recall hearing this before. A star.
Well, it might have been, like just a map that was moving, but when your sole points of reference are these points of light, it's
right.
Kind of... I was already unsteady on my feet, so I decided to quit messing with that. And, in hindsight, what if it was actually moving where the craft was,
Good point.
Turning it upside down or something? could crash it or something. I don't know.
All right. But anyway, one quick question before we go on, and that is, you know, from the moment you woke up, Travis, did you have any sense at all of how much time had passed or whether a lot of time had passed while you were...
I had no idea.
No idea.
You know, my initial impression was, since this was the first thing I was remembering since, you know, turning to run away, I thought it was immediately afterwards, but in hindsight, it could have been a day or two or, you know, who knows how long afterwards.
Okay.
And also very far away.
Okay. What is your sense of the totality of time that you spent on the craft? How long?
Well, the conscious memory that I had upon return, it was a very brief period of time. I figured it was less than an hour, but obviously 5 days and 6 hours.
Wow.
Everybody leaps to the question, well, what about time dilation? You travel near the speed of light and time passes more slowly for you.
Right.
Well, the thing that refutes that was when I told my brother, you know, said something immediately upon being recovered, something he said about my mom worrying these days, he could tell that I thought it was still the same night.
Wow.
And he said, Travis, you've been gone 5 days. Feel your face. And I had a 5-day growth of beard, and that is what overturns the time dilation idea.
All right, Travis, hold it right there. We've got a quick break. Travis Walton is my guest. I'm Art Bell, and this is Midnight in the Desert. Stay right where you are.
From the high desert and the great American Southwest, this is Midnight in the Desert, exclusively on the Dark Matter Digital Network. To call the show, dial 1-952-CALL-ART. That's 1-952-225-5278.
A rare interview with Travis Walton, abductee, real abductee. This is not lessening anybody else's story. It's just there's so much cooperation for this that I feel very comfortable in saying real abductee. Travis, I get questions, and by the way, people are asking, what was the movie? My goodness, it is a long time ago. It's called Fire in the Sky, and you can still see it, and we've got updated stuff for you coming up. We'll tell you all about it in a moment.
I saw it on television night before last. It's still showing out there.
It sure is.
And it was on Netflix last I heard.
There you go. Joe wants to know what the device, the medical device you thought it was, what did that look like, the one on you?
Well, it was glowing, kind of a greenish glow coming from underneath it. So I don't know whether it was some kind of a treatment device designed to repair the damage that was done internally, or if it was something designed to diagnose or look inside. I definitely think my regaining consciousness was unexpected and actually kind of put a kink in their efforts to revive me.
All right.
You know, for many years I thought that you know, I was taken aboard for experiments or to torture me, but it was actually probably more about reviving me.
Richard asks, did Travis get the feeling that the aliens didn't care whether you lived or died? In other words, did you feel they were caring for you, about you, or just sort of didn't?
That Richard's question is related to what I was just saying, that at the time, their complete lack of emotion, I interpreted it as hostility. But in total perspective, analyzing what happened, the way it fits in with the medical tests afterwards and how I was returned and everything, it took me years to realize that it was probably more of an ambulance call than an abduction, that I got myself hurt and that made it necessary to take me aboard just to avoid leaving me there as galactic roadkill.
You said you didn't feel as though you were more than about an hour in total had passed on board the craft, yes?
Yeah, a very brief period of time. Of course, in a state of complete hysteria, it seems like forever. But, you know, when you piece together what happened and, you know, even the waiting periods, it was less than I thought, you know. It certainly doesn't account for the entire time. But there were little glimmers of memory, and, you know, the hypnosis reinforces this, that there were blocked memories that happened that I'm unable to recollect even after all this time, that other than what, you know, came out under that first hypnosis session.
What did come out under the hypnosis session? What did you find out?
You know, up to that point, I was so traumatized that I could hardly finish a sentence about it. And I had not really told the entire story of what I had experienced to anyone, including my brother, until that hypnosis. And it was because it was just so traumatic, I'd break down. I could hardly finish a sentence. And so the technique was to separate the fear from the experience.
Okay.
And although there was a great deal of fear in what I was relating, remaining, but it was still enough to where I could tell them what happened.
All right. So how did you get from the craft? I mean, we last left you going down a hall or passageway or something. And then what?
Well, my unskilled, I would say, button pushing, trying to open a door, must have attracted some attention. I don't know, maybe coincidentally, this person came in that I took to be a human being from some Earth-based space agency or military arm of from the Earth, and but I really think now that that wasn't the case. He took me out of this craft, and at this point, it was parked. It was inside of this big hangar-like structure. It could have been a building somewhere on a military base or somewhere.
Really?
Or it could have been a part of a larger craft. It had a sort of a look to the roof and wall that looked sort of like I'd seen in airplane hangars. But it the light coming from these panels could have been filtered sunlight through a translucent panel, or it might have been an artificial natural light sort of light fixture.
Okay.
I have no idea where it was. I couldn't see out through these windows, or if they were windows.
At any point, did any of these creatures communicate with you in any way, either vocally or telepathically?
I think that excruciating encounter initially with the three of them was an attempt to say something telepathically. And I was curious about why it was so excruciating until I connected to possibly that I was injured and the receiver, so to speak, wasn't operating correctly.
Mm-hmm.
I was interviewed the same day for this new movie coming up called 701, which refers to the 701 unresolved Blue Book cases. This movie is in the works yet, but I was interviewed the same day as these school kids from Zimbabwe, and I asked the young lady what that felt like when these you know, I don't know if you heard about this, but there were, you know, if everyone heard about this thing where there's like 60 kids at recess in broad daylight, this craft came down, these aliens, like I've described, came out and communicated to them through this stare. And I wanted to know if it was excruciating, like for them, like it was for me. And they said no, it was very pleasant. The message wasn't unpleasant. It was friendly. And so that convinces me all the more that it was just an attempt with extreme aggressiveness, force of the combined force of the three of them trying to get control of me before I hurt them or actually hurt myself, because I think my unscheduled regaining of consciousness interrupted some life-saving repairs. And so that's the reason for a human-looking person to come in and take me out.
Fully human?
And I think, apparently, in most ways, there was something odd about the eyes. But again, I go back to the biology. See, Scott are really fond of saying, this is ridiculous. There are no aliens because everybody reports bipedal, two hands, two legs, you know, a head on top.
Right.
Oh, they're not going to look anything like that. They're going to be a tentacled octopus. Well, that's ridiculous. If you understand the principles of biology, bilateral symmetry is almost, throughout all life on Earth, no matter how diverse it is. And you have many cases where animals that resemble each other very, very much are completely unrelated just because they are in a similar ecological niche, a certain mm-hmm. similar environment.
Sure. These creatures, were they wearing helmets or were they breathing if
well,
they
the
were
human
breathing?
Looking was, the
human
little,
one.
What so-called grays. We're not wearing anything but coveralls, but the human-looking one is wearing a helmet over his head.
Huh.
And so that was the reason I sort of accepted the fact that he was not responding to my babbling, my screaming, begging questions, you know.
All right, I'm going back to my computer for a second here with a question.
That helmet on.
Yes, I've got it. Heather would like to know, she may have information. Is it true Travis was found to have radiation signatures in his blood that can only be found if a person is exposed to radiation, like in space, outside of Earth's atmosphere?
That is an untrue rumor. Unfortunately, that specific test was not performed. That kind of evidence might have been apparent had they done such a test. However, the trees nearest where the craft came down do have definite markers of having a huge radiation dose.
Wow.
And we can get into that in detail, but this accelerated growth that was generated in these trees has been duplicated in the pine trees. It's a Scots pine tree species near the Chernobyl nuclear accident that's very similar to ponderosa pine, where this forest was, and the radiation at Chernobyl caused an accelerated growth there, just like it did at the clearing. Now, the trees nearest where the craft came down had the greatest accelerated growth, and then the effect faded back into the woods. And most interestingly, the most recent discovery was that the accelerated growth was primarily on the side of the tree in the direction of the craft.
Wow.
So in a circle of trees around where the craft came down, the thickened growth would be on the east, west, south, or north, on whatever side was facing the craft, which completely undercuts any skeptic's idea that there was some growth effect that had nothing to do with the craft.
This is all new information to me.
It's new research, yes.
When was this outed?
This was discovered in an expedition overseen by Ben Hansen. He was the host of the TV series Fact or Fake,
uh-huh.
former FBI agent. He oversaw an expedition back there, and we were able to check that this accelerated growth, which we were aware of from going way back, but we didn't know it was directional until this last year when we were able to get a complete cross-section of the trees. And this high radiation was detected with Geiger counters on the men's hard hats during the search. And also, when I exited the truck, I left the door open.
Right.
And the crewman that was in the open doorway was Ken Peterson. And his right arm, the arm towards the open door, has recently been diagnosed with skin cancer, which, again, is a
sign of maybe radiation. Yeah.
Some high radiation coming at them. No, the blood tests didn't reveal that, but unfortunately, those kind of tests weren't run at the time.
Yes, indeed. Since the experience, have you noticed any changes in yourself? Psychic abilities, better understanding of yourself or anybody else or life itself? In other words, did it profoundly change you in some way?
All of the above. But I'd rather not get into that stuff. I have tried very hard to stick to things that I can document.
Right.
And some things became documentable later, so I was able to talk about them later.
Like the radiation, but you're trying to avoid the woo-woo factor.
Right.
I get
but
that.
There's definitely some strange things that have become apparent.
All right, let me get, again, so you were in this hangar-like place.
Yeah.
I want to know how you got back to, I don't know, Earth.
He took me to some other people dressed similarly to him, except they didn't have helmets. And so I thought, well, maybe they can hear me. Maybe they'll answer my questions.
Right.
You know, I was a babbling idiot. I was screaming, crying, you know, carrying on. I was basically out of my mind with fear. But they weren't responding to me. And in a way, you know, it might not have been so much secrecy or, you know, anything covert or suspicious that they wouldn't respond to me. It was just that I was acting like a maniac, and they felt that tried to reason with somebody so out of control would be futile.
Mm-hmm.
So they forced me down on this table and rendered me unconscious with some sort of a gas. And boom, next thing I woke was back on Earth. But
Where were you when you woke up back on Earth? Where were you? It showed you in the movie at a gas station or something.
Well, I woke up and I was lying face down in the dark on a cold pavement. But there was a and I looked to see where the light was coming from, but it went off. But when I looked up, I could still see the shiny bottom of this craft hovering there, just for an instant before it shot straight up into the air. But I think probably quite a bit of time went on between the time I was put unconscious and the time I was lying there on the pavement. I could feel that my clothes were still warm, even though the pavement was very cold, the air was very cold.
All right, the movie showed you naked as a jaybird. Not true.
Not true. Not okay. True. You know, it was dreadful. I mean, they actually filmed a sequence where the actor portraying me came upon a couple getting busy in a car. They're naked, and he's naked, and they start screaming. He starts screaming. They said it was so bad that it was mercifully deleted from the film. But I guess the nakedness is a good metaphor for the feeling of that I had in a variety of ways, that these beings, the small ones, could look into me. They knew what I was thinking. They could see into me. It was an intrusive, invasive kind of feeling. And then in the aftermath, the way the media microscopically analyzed my every move to an absurd extent, every, you know, childish act of bravado or whatever, you know, motorcycle stunts or whatever, was just blown out of proportion. And You know, they were just looking for anything that they could interpret as strange. So, you know, the whole idea of being the bug in the jar began on board the craft and continued for months after I was returned.
All right, hold it right there. We're gonna break. Whew. Travis Walton is my guest. He's an abductee. Been there, done that, and back. I'm Art Bell.
I hear the drums echoing tonight. She hears only whispers of some quiet conversation. She's coming in 12:30 flight. The moonlit wings reflect the stars that guide me toward salvation. I stopped an old man along the way, hoping to find some old forgotten words or ancient melodies.
And Midnight in the Desert is pounding packets your way on the Dark Matter Digital Network. To call the show, please direct your finger digits to dial 1-952-225-5278. That's 1-952-CALL-ART.
A rare interview with Travis Walton, abductee. Okay, Travis, here's one for you. You talked to us about the aliens and then what seemed to be more human-like characters. So an obvious question would seem to be, do you think that that means that we know all about the aliens, that we are in some way cooperating with them? You got taken because they perhaps thought you were hurt. They didn't want you. They didn't want you to wake up. And when you did, they wanted you the hell out of there. And so those humans that you say you saw may have been, well, who knows, government types? Is that possible?
Well, that's possible, and that's what I initially thought. But now, you know, going further into the skeptic's idea that no way would they even be vaguely humanoid, let alone human-looking, is preposterous when you look at the biology behind it. It's entirely possible that they're not us from the future, or us from the past, or related to us, or that we were seated here by them. It's entirely possible that they just have a particular keener interest in us because of our similarity, which is just coincidental. Hmm. I predict that when we look at life on other worlds, they're not going to be astonished at how bizarre these life forms are. They're going to be amazed at the similarity of forms. They uncovered a fossil of a marsupial that is built just like a saber-toothed cat. It was a predator, and yet biologically completely unrelated, but very, very similar because of the niche that it filled in the ecology. We have javelina in the Southwest that look like pigs, have tusks and behaviors in so many ways like pigs, and they're not pigs at all.
Mm-hmm.
The American pronghorn is not even a true antelope, and it resembles so much a particular African antelope species because our American pronghorn evolved here on the American continent in the presence of the American cheetah, which is now extinct. And because of the similarity in the environment, it takes on a similar form and a similar ability. Every animal that winds up living in the water, whether it be a mammal, a bird, or a reptile, or an amphibian, they all come to look very fish-like because the environment shapes the animal.
Okay, but clearly you were looking at two different species. I mean, you were looking at what, aliens and at something close to human.
Yeah, and I think that they were brought in, summoned, or their assistance was gained because of the, I would be less combative, and they would be able to get some degree of cooperation and get me sedated to the point where they could finish the repairs, and B, they would know more and probably have more equipment and whatnot to deal with the nature of my injuries, which is why it took 5 days.
Okay. Dale asks, again, this is from the wormhole, do you still have nightmares about this event?
I did for a long time, but that gradually faded away. Now, the dreams that came back later were not so much nightmares, but actually featured the human-type people to a much greater extent, but with a much different emotional feel to it.
Fascinating. I haven't kept up on all the other guys who were on your crew, or Mike's crew. Obviously, we're going to get a pretty good feel for how you're doing these days, which, thankfully, is pretty good. How are the other guys doing? Do you know?
Well, come to find out, Alan Dallas had a heart attack and died here a couple of years ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And last year, I found out that Dwayne Smith had also passed away from a heart attack. And, you know, I had had quite a bit of difficulty tracking Dwayne Smith down. I had a friend who was a former police officer who enlisted the help of a friend who was a private detective, found him. I talked to him on the phone, interviewed him, and fortunately I taped the interview because, you know, he agreed that he would come out and speak with me. But, you know, he had some real problems with his teeth, and he wanted to get them fixed before he'd appear on camera.
Right.
But he passed away Thanksgiving before last.
Wow. Wow. So many are gone is the answer. And
yeah. Two of them have gone. Mike's had some health problems of some strokes and whatnot, but he's fought back pretty good. He's back to actually, you know, doing tree work. He does residential tree service now. John Gillette is back in the area locally, and so is Ken. He moved back into this area.
All right. Would you? I want to plug what you've got a documentary, and we're going to talk about that in a moment, and also whatever else you've got going on. So there is new information out there that people can get, and we're going to tell them how. What I really would like to do is, would you mind answering a few phone calls?
Absolutely.
Good, good. Travis Walton is my guest. If you want to call us, the public number is area code 952-225-5278. Rare opportunity. 952-225-5278. North America, meaning America and Canada, can get us at MITD51 on Skype, MITD51. If you're outside North America or Canada, you can call on Skype using MITD55. That's MITD55. So if you have a question for him, and I can't imagine you don't, pick up the phone or pick up Skype and join us. Travis Walton, Midnight in the Desert.
Love. Dark Matter News, I'm Leo Ashcraft. The increase in availability of drones is all but certainly to cause an airplane accident, in part because it's difficult to catch people in the act of flying the small unmanned drones. CBS News aviation and safety expert Chelsea Sullenberger said Sunday that we've seen what a 6-pound or an 8-pound bird can do to bring down an airplane. She said on Face the Nation, a nod to the flock of the birds that knocked out both of the engines and forced him to land a plane in the Hudson River in 2009. Imagine what a device containing hard parts like batteries and motors can do that might weigh 25 or possibly up to 55 pounds to bring down an airplane. It's not a matter of if it will happen, it's a matter of when it will happen. There's been a dramatic increase in the number of unmanned aircraft flying near commercial planes, and in some cases, pilots have had to alter their courses to avoid a collision. Sullenberger said the devices are becoming ubiquitous because they are relatively cheap and easy to procure, but that it allows people to do stupid, reckless, dangerous things with abandon. He says he's encouraged that aviation and the legal authorities have raised the penalties for doing these things, adding that the essential element that's still missing is the certainty of prosecution because it's been difficult to catch them in the act. Well, the Mars rover has been producing quite a few interesting photographs, to say the least, lately. One appears to be a ghostly woman, and another one may indicate an infestation of crabs on Mars. This recent Mars photograph seems to show a giant alien crab. Well, the mysterious object closely resembles the crustacean anyway. It's unknown exactly who found it, but it's really interesting. It does appear alive. It may be a crab-like animal, or it might also be a plant. This object has many arms, and one of them goes to the left of the picture a very long ways. That arm is longer than all the others. Plant or animal, well, it really doesn't matter. The significance of this may be that it might show signs of life on Mars. Take a look at the photos yourself and let us know what you see at darkmatternews.com. It's Friday. That means open line night on Art Bell. Let us know what you think of the stories on Dark Matter News tonight. And remember, you can always submit a tip online at darkmatternews.com.
After last night's show on Bigfoot, we've had earthquakes, meteors, asteroids, UFOs, volcanic activity, and something has shaken loose. Bigfoot, Yeti, the Sasquatch, the abominable snowman, whatever you may call it, showed up today in North Carolina. Little Eric and little dog Yippee, they caught it firsthand and on video. The recording is of a Sasquatch mating call, war scream, or a greeting from some other dimension. Here it comes. It continues to haunt me. In the terrifying last few moments of Art Bell's show, final caller came in with a recording that still sends chills down my spine.
I guess, do you want me to end your show with what I would think may be a Bigfoot scream that I heard out there in the woods in southeast Oklahoma?
I wouldn't miss it for the world, man. Go ahead.
And with North Korea rolling their time back 30 minutes, you may not even have heard this yet. And for those of you following politics, Fox News and Facebook will no longer be hosting GOP debates. The WWE has picked up the contract. And after Trump's shrewd remarks during the debate, Rosie O'Donnell fires back with this crazy tweet. It continues to haunt me. This is John G. with Dark Matter News.
the numbers by now, I hope. There is going to be an upcoming documentary. In other words, there has been a lot of information since all this happened, since the movie was made. Not everything in the movie was just so. So there's a brand new, I guess brand new, 90-minute documentary called Travis. Tell us about it.
Well, it's produced by On Wings Production. That's O-N-W-I-N-G-E-S.
Right.
Production.com. And it interviews a lot of the prominent researchers in the fields, some who have been active since it happened originally and some more recent to the scene. But
all about your case.
Yes, all about my case. It's a 90-minute film. It's won a couple of EBE awards. And it's really a fantastic film, very thorough accounting.
Boy, we're getting some interference on this line. I don't know if you can hear it on your end or not.
Yeah, I hear it.
You do.
We had some sabotage attempt on our local fiber optic node. And
Oh, that would account for the little breakup I hear, as well as the as well as the static. All right. So this
Someone
documentary
went around and took a shotgun to various
wonderful
fiber optic junctions.
Wonderful. I bet that's fun to fix. Anyway, this documentary, where can people get it? How is it obtained?
Well, like I said, through onwingsproductions.com or through my website, traviswalton.com.
Excellent. Also, you've got a conference coming up, right?
Yeah, this is the 40th anniversary of the event, and we've got quite a lineup of speakers. Tracy Torme, who is the original screenwriter on Five Sky, will be there, and his co-producer on 701, the movie, James Fox, will also be speaking. We've got David Childress, Ben Hansen, Lee Spiegel from the Huffington Post, UFO editor, Paola Harris. Oh, Lynn Katai will be speaking about the Phoenix Lights. And I've got Robert...
Morning Sky?
Yuri Arte and Noe Torres. They wrote a book called Cowboys and Aliens, and I think it's fascinating to go back to the prehistory of UFOs and show that this is not some kind of a phenomenon exclusive to post Roswell. I mean, this goes way back, reports in the American Southwest.
All right, here's a big question. Gilberto wants to know by computer, were you ever debriefed, it's a good question, by any government agency about the abduction experience? I would think they would be interested.
You would think they would, and it's very, very curious that I have received no interest from any government agency. Now, it was widely suspected for a long time that our chief debunker for many years, Philip Klass, was acting as some kind of a covert disinformationist on behalf of some government agency. And he harassed the heck out of Mike Rogers, and he offered to, you know, discredit it. And this bribe offer is well documented. It was carried by local deputy James Click. And you, Art, challenged Philip Klass to take a polygraph test on the air.
I did.
Call.
Yes.
And you got quite a bit of backlash over that. Well, you have been vindicated. Through the Freedom of Information Act, after Klass passed away, his FBI file revealed some very interesting stuff that I wish you had been able to get Philip Klass to take a polygraph test, because I think he would have flunked it in regards to his covert disinformationist role.
Well, I don't think anybody in the audience is surprised that that kind of thing is going on. All right, let's see who we've got. Richard, somewhere out in the world, you're on with Travis. Hi.
Good morning, Art. It's Richard from Northern Ireland.
Northern Ireland, and, okay.
Yep. And great show as always. And a big shout out to Bell Gab. And I have a question for Travis.
Okay.
You know what the internet's like, Travis? And there was a suggestion a few years ago that perhaps what you stumbled upon was some great government project, and in fact the whole alien thing was a result of hallucinogens force-fed to you. Is there any truth or any possibility that's the case?
No, there's no possibility to that. You know, that was kind of a theory that was put forth because people were desperate to explain it away. And, you know, well, why does he pass a lie detector test? Well, he believes it happened. So he really hallucinated it, and it didn't really happen, but he thinks it did. But, you know, that theory and the transitory psychosis theory and another one involving hypnosis have no basis because it doesn't explain how seven people can have an identical hallucination.
Really? All right, let's go.
Also, medical tests showed no trace of any drug in my body.
Thank you. Scott, you're on the air with Travis. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. All right.
Yes.
Yeah. Travis, I have a question for you. Do you think that the spotlight on you, because now you have a celebrity status, do you think that now that you have a celebrity status, maybe the ETs are kind of backing away from you a little bit?
I don't know. If that were a security measure, then okay. But I don't know. You know, here at February 4 last, I was driving, leaving a MUFON meeting in L.A. I was going north up the 5 towards the 10 to come back to Arizona. I was with my girlfriend and my son, and we saw a giant triangular black craft come low overhead, you know, undeniable, incredibly close. And I was astonished that you would have something over a city the size of L.A. and not have all kinds of reports. Well, we did a little research online. My son found this website called UFOstalker.com, and at that exact time and place, there were over a dozen reports of the same thing. So others saw it, too.
I saw one of them, Travis, a big triangular craft. Scott, anything else?
Well, yes. I live over here in Massachusetts. Actually, I had a sighting myself, actually, but it was more of a ring of light. Have either you, Art, or Travis heard of like a ring of light that would float above somebody? Because that's actually what I saw above myself. It came, I don't know, about 10 feet above my vehicle, actually. And it was it came really close, and it floated really close, and then it just ascended right up in the sky. I was
okay, well, that would be a big no from me. What about you, Travis? Any ring?
I've heard of such reports, but I haven't seen such a thing myself.
I'm sure everybody comes to you now with every story. I mean, they do with me. You know, once they know that you're open to that kind of thing, they really come to you a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go to, I don't know, Yorkton. Is that correct? Saskatchewan, perhaps?
Yes, absolutely correct again there, Art.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call, and hello, Travis. I actually have two questions. First one is, do you think that the aliens are here to help us? Because you always hear that there's the negative experiences, but do you think that they're here for the good or the bad is the first question.
Well, you know, this is just my opinion, and it mostly speaks to the species that I encountered, and I really do not see them as malevolent. However, I think that there is something that's, you know, been suggested in science fiction as the Prime Directive, the Non-Interference Directive, that it's against the rules to overtly infuse any kind of technology because, you know, that's like giving matches to kids, you know.
Yeah.
We're just going to use it to hurt ourselves. So it makes sense that they're not going to do it. And I can expound on this a little further. You know, the skeptics are fond of saying, if this was real, they'd land on the White House lawn and say, here we are, Mr. President.
That's right.
But I also posit that with their level of technology so far beyond ours, that they are perfectly capable of doing everything that they're doing here and remain completely undetected. There would be no ufology. There would be no sightings. They could accomplish that, I believe.
Sure.
So you have to explain why it's neither extreme. In my view, these glimpses, which are just barely provable enough to let this knowledge, this awareness, filter through the population in a way that doesn't have the kind of overwhelming disruptive effect that just instant open disclosure would have.
Right. Caller?
That sounds great. And one more quick question, if I can. Did he, Travis, did you see any more people up there with you, or is it just you?
Okay.
Well, there were some other human-looking beings, but, you know, like in the movie where there were human cadavers and that's, or artifacts of other people having been there, no, I did not see that.
All right. Off to Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hello.
That's right. Hello, Art. How's it going?
It's going okay. Turn your radio or whatever off, please.
Yep, we'll do right now.
Okay.
Got it.
All right.
Yep.
Proceed.
All right. Hi, I have a question for Travis. It's part of pop culture that the aliens, when they abduct you, they stick probes in you. Is there any truth to that?
You mean did it happen to Travis?
Yes. Yeah, okay. Did it happen to Travis?
Right.
Did they like actually penetrate him with any probes? Or did
right. Okay, I've got it. They showed in the movie about the most horrible scene anybody could imagine with this needle coming to Travis's trapped eye. Oh, God, that was awful. I'm so glad that didn't happen to you, Travis. Anything else?
Well, there was an array of instruments there laid out. I had great apprehension about how they might have been used initially, thinking that, you know, some bizarre effects could come out later, but I really think that they were just simply there to try to help, and so I don't think anything, I have no conscious memory of any probing or anything. I think what was done medically was just to correct a terrible accident that I brought on myself by getting too close unexpectedly.
Got it. All right, let's go to Scott. Hello, Scott, on Skype. You're on the air.
Hi, Travis.
Get closer to your computer, sir. You sound like you're in a deep hall somewhere.
Okay, can you hear me out?
That's better.
Okay. Art and Travis, it's great to talk to you both. It's Scott in Vancouver. I'm listening to you on TuneIn Radio.
Yes,
and,
sir.
This is one of the most fantastic stories, obviously, that I've ever heard. You know, I've heard Travis speak over the years, and the only thing a few people have touched on it. What have you, has time woken any memories up that might have been buried? Has anything come forward that might have been hidden before? Was there a message? I mean, you hear about these kids in South Africa that were it was imparted to them that we have to save the planet. Was there any direct message to you?
Mm-hmm.
So a few questions kind of combined there, and I'll listen off there.
All right. Travis?
Well, back about the time I was doing so many interviews for the movie, I started having these memories, little dreams or whatever, glimmers coming through involving these human-looking type of people. And I went to Tracy Torme, the screenwriter on the film, and I asked him, do you think that there could be some memories returning? And he said, no. He said, it's probably just, you know, because you're doing all these interviews, that it's probably just dreams. And so I asked him the same question here recently, and he says, oh, yeah, there was probably memories leaking back through. So he profoundly changed his opinion. But none of those memories, really constitute any useful information. They were just glimmers of things. It was definitely had a much more positive feeling than the earlier nightmares that I had.
You're a very lucky guy because there was so much corroboration, lie detector tests. I mean, so many people, witnesses, the whole schmear. You had it all. There are other abductees who tell stories, But without that kind of cooperation, do you have any feelings about the whole abduction phenomenon, people who tell these stories?
I think there's a whole mix of things going on. It's a variety of things, all of the above, actually. You know, some of it is extremely vivid memory. Some of it is delusion. Some of it is misidentified ordinary things. But I believe there's a core reality here of other events and sightings and things that have happened. And just because someone is unable to document it doesn't mean it's not true. But, you know, in terms of trying to get the public to become aware that there is a core reality here, that's the reason I stick to documentation. It's not like that's what you have to have, but that's for it to be true, but that's what you need to have in order to bring people along and make them realize we're not alone and this is real.
You're right. You dropped a sort of a hint earlier that there have been changes in you that you don't really want to describe, and I jumped and said because of the woo-woo factor. I'm dying to know what they are.
All right, I'll give you what I can document.
Really?
I didn't want to say anything about the health effects because I couldn't document it, but I went into my employers and got the documentation that I never called in sick one time in the last 39 years.
Wow.
And so that's
wow.
unusual. That's unusual.
It's extremely unusual. Are you kidding? 39 years?
Yeah.
You never called in sick once?
No. No.
So if anything, you got a health benefit?
Possibly. I mean, it could be a coincidence that I'm healthy. But, you know, I never missed a day of work except for funerals and things, you know.
Hazleton, Pennsylvania, your turn with... Travis Walton, hi.
Hi, good to both of you. Very interesting. I missed the very beginning of the show. Where did this happen?
It happened south of Heber Obregard, Arizona.
Okay.
Up on the Mogollon Rim, over 7,000 feet elevation, up in the Ponderosa Pines of the Sitgreaves National Forest, very near the border to the Apache reservation.
And you talked about when they left you out of the craft or whatever it was, you were in some kind of a hangar, is that it?
Yeah, apparently, either a hangar or maybe possibly a larger craft.
And how did you get out of that?
Well, I was rendered unconscious, but when I woke up, I was returned. So obviously, they transported me to a vehicle after I was unconscious and brought me back. And in a way that really just reinforced my theory that it was with concern for my welfare. I mean, they could have dumped me off on some asteroid or even back in the woods where it happened, where I would have froze to death before I got help. So,
but you didn't know the time that was happening, right? You didn't know when you were being transported. You didn't you have no consciousness of that at all, right?
Right. Yeah.
Wow.
They kept me out.
Wow.
Well, blocked some memories. I do think with these little glimmers that have been coming through, that there, at least part of that time I wasn't in a coma or under anesthesia, that part of the time there was some kind of interaction, especially with these human-looking beings.
Okay, the documentary name again?
Is Travis. I didn't name it. That's not my ego playing there. They named it Travis.
You deserve a documentary name. No problem. We'll tell everybody how to get it. Stay right there. We're up against break. It'll be a quick one, and we'll be right back. Travis Walton is my guest. His story is always the same. A few new things, but always the same.
Who's gonna tell you when it's too late? Who's gonna tell you things aren't so great? Thank you.
felt it. I tried to beat you, but you're so hot that I melted. I fell right through the cracks, and now I'm trying to get back. Before the cool done run out, I'll be giving it my bestest, and nothing's gonna stop me but divine intervention. I reckon it's again my turn to win some or learn some.
Take a walk on the wild side of midnight. From the Kingdom of Nye, this is Midnight in the Desert with Art Bell. Please call the show at 1-952-225-5278. That's 1-952-CALL-ART.
Well, all right. Travis Walton is my guest. Very unusual to get the opportunity to interview Travis. He's got a new documentary coming out called Travis. And again, I guess you can go to his website and order it. How much, Travis?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I think it's 25. I think it's 25.
All right. And you also have a conference coming up called Sky Fire Summit, right?
Yes, November 5th, 6th, and 7th in Heber Oregard, the town nearest where it happened. And we are going to have a visit to the site on the anniversary.
Oh, no kidding.
And a really neat sky watch with some special equipment.
How is it dealing with celebrity? Somebody mentioned that earlier, and this, of course, is going to be with you all your life. How have you dealt with it since the incident? Are you patient with people, or is it really rough? Are you eating dinner a lot of times? Somebody comes up and wants an autograph or what have you?
Yeah, you just washed your hands and they want to shake your hand. I'm eating.
Always,
no,
yeah.
No, actually, I have total patience for that. I totally understand. You know, one thing that, Dr. Harder, right after it happened, put me on the phone with Betty Hill, and I got some advice from her about that, about not letting it change you.
Mm-hmm.
And I really took that to heart. I've worked very hard at not letting it affect me one way or the other. I'm not going to accept the idea that I'm a crazy kook or a liar. And by the same token, I can't accept the idea that I'm some kind of a great person. The what happened was an extraordinary event. That doesn't necessarily make me an extraordinary person. See,
I do, and I do understand what it's like to deal with celebrity. And you have to be patient with people because at times they do jump in at the oddest moments.
It's fortunate I live in a very out of the way place, and I'm a little bit harder to reach. But when I go out, I try to be gracious with people, understand their interest, and do my best, because that's my mission, is to educate people. And
well, on their behalf, thank you for that. On Skype, Jacob, you are on the air. Hi.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I have a question for Travis.
Yes.
If you were to encounter a UFO again, how do you think you would react? Do you think you'd feel the same kind of fear, or do you think you might perhaps try a more diplomatic approach this time around?
Yeah, that's a good question.
In other words, would I do what people say? Oh, I would stay calm and ask good questions. Well, you know, the fear that came on was an accidental conspiracy of circumstances that made it seem far more threatening, which it actually wasn't. And I think I would handle it better, but I don't know that I would voluntarily be so foolish as to get myself injured again. However, it would be great to have some questions answered. But the big question is, would I tell anybody? And I have to say, probably not.
When thinking now of this entire incident, are there things, not that I need to know them, that you have not made public?
Yeah, but, you know, like I say, I just try to stick to what I can document and leave it at that, you know, because it's important to, you know, show people that there's a reality here, and I don't want to put anything out there that can be questioned, even though it's as real as any of it. If I can't prove it, I'm not going to talk about it.
I so understand that. Hello there. Wherever you are, you're on the air. Turn your device off or down, please.
How you doing, Art? It's Grizz on TuneIn Chat. I want to say hi to everybody on TuneIn.
Yes, sir.
And my question is, what did the alien smell like? What was the ship? Oh. What did it smell like? No one ever describes that.
Right. You're absolutely right. It's a good question.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, a lot of people do have a description of the smell, and that's actually a pretty common question that people wonder about that. But I don't recall the sense of smell. And normally when you have an intense emotional experience, that the smell is very intimately linked with memory. But in my case, other than feeling very stale and humid, it may be that the atmosphere in there was so strange, it wasn't appropriate for a human, obviously, because the human-looking guy that came in was wearing a helmet, and unless that was for some other reason.
You said stale and humid. So, obviously, it's not like you felt air. Obviously, you were breathing air, but you didn't feel air moving at all. It was just sort of a very dank environment.
Yeah, very humid, and I was breathing hard all the time, and I just felt like I could not get enough air. So I think that either the blast of energy damaged my lungs or maybe even the neurological part of my brain responsible for breathing, or that atmosphere in there was just not right for humans, and maybe some of both.
Yeah, maybe they got as close as they could get. Chris, hello on Skype. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well.
Good. I was calling up. Thank you for having me on. It's an honor to be on. Don, you described, you know, that on the movie Fire in the Sky, that the craft wasn't what it looked like, you said. But I had my own encounter. I won't get into that. But the one we did, we had an encounter with the craft had a huge glass dome on top of it. Did you happen to notice if there was a huge glass dome on top of the craft that you've seen? You know,
yeah,
you see so many.
You know, there was a dome on top. There was a dome on top, but I did not look out from it from the inside. I never got to that part of the craft, but it did have a dome on top.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, that was just was wondering. Like I said, I had my own experience and. It's fascinating. It's very fascinating. And you said that most of your memories were hit through when you got back through hypnosis.
Well, no, actually, you know, it didn't add to the memories. It just allowed me to finally say them without breaking down.
What's it like being hypnotized? Is it pretty weird? I mean, are you conscious during it and aware of your surroundings and is it just that other memories come flooding back, or what was it like?
I didn't really remember when I came out of the trance. My brother was present, and he told me about certain things that I didn't remember.
Interesting.
I understand some people do remember, but I didn't.
Gotcha. Flagstaff, Arizona, your turn. Hello.
Hi, thanks.
Sure. Go ahead.
Hi, my name's Zach. I'm from Arizona. Hi, Travis, up north, and Flagstaff. And my question for you is that I feel like earlier in what happened to you, a lot of what you were saying was like there was an attack on you by extraterrestrial life. So my question now is that just hearing you earlier in the show, you feel like there's more of an altruistic aspect to extraterrestrial life now, like they weren't trying to hurt you.
Well, yeah. You see, I didn't. I interpreted it as an attack. You know, that possibly this blast of energy was even a beam that was fired, even mistakenly, as a defensive move. But now I'm thinking that it was just some kind of a side effect of the propulsion unit that just jumped to the Earth through me. Our famous UFO skeptic even wrote a paper saying that pilots who think they see they're being circled by UFOs are actually seeing the result of the huge charges up to 500,000 volts that actually have been documented to build up in the surface of our aircraft just passing at high speed through the air. So, you know, maybe some kind of a an effect like that of this saucer traveling through the air at very high speed, or maybe some side effect of the propulsion unit, or maybe they were in the process of some agricultural experiment there with the trees and some residual energy from that. I don't know. I just don't think it was a deliberate weapon. I think that because I unexpectedly closed the distance and got myself hurt, that it made it necessary for them to take me aboard to correct the mistake that I made. So I'm not saying that they were that it was a hostile act at all, as I mistakenly may have thought at first.
All right. Caller?
All right. Thanks.
Right. Thank you very much. Okay, so here's a question from somebody named Big C through the wormhole. Great show. Question to Travis. Was he a skeptic of the existence of ETs, UFOs, that sort of thing, before this happened to you? I mean, did you have any attitude at all about this?
No, I was not that ignorant. I really, studies have shown that over 60% of the people believe in the reality of this, and to the extent, and the percentage goes up with the educational level. So it's really dumb people who say this can't be, because we've reached the point now where it's a virtual certainty with accepted scientific methods. We have the Hubble telescope and Kepler, and they've actually been able to fill in the blanks on the Drake equation, that the estimation of habitable or life-supporting planets in our galaxy is far greater than they once thought, that virtually every star has about a dozen planets, and that there's always going to be those middle ones, the Goldilocks range, that aren't so close that they're overheated or so far out that they're frozen, and life with the right chemicals is going to be inevitable in those places.
You're beginning to sound like a scientist. Of course, you've been looking at this now for a while, haven't you?
I've been studying it for 39 years, yeah.
All right, let's, I don't know. It says anonymous, so I don't know where we're going. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Art.
Hello.
Calling from Phoenix, Arizona.
Yes, sir.
And last year, my wife and I were at the Skyfire Summit in the Heber-Overdrive area with hosted by Travis, and he had two Navajo rangers that were speaking at the event, and these guys were super intense. I mean, we had a conversation, my wife and I, with one of them outside after he spoke, and he had federal, law enforcement training, and this guy would look right through you, a no-holds-barred kind of guy, and I was curious as to how Travis met them in this. They ever teamed up together, with Travis's conviction of his story, and these two gentlemen, it would make a powerful combination to, go on a circuit.
Okay, Travis?
Well, I had the opportunity to speak in Gallup at a film festival there on the Navajo Reservation, and spoke to nearly 1,000 Native Americans in the building, and they had some amazing stories about things that happened way back in the far reaches of the reservation. It's very remote out there, and these entities seem to have quite an attraction to more remote areas. This one story I got was of a guy, his grandmother had woven a blanket depicting an encounter with these beings going way back. So, the oral tradition amongst the tribes, the Zuni, the Navajo, the Hopi, is pretty extensive, that this is not a new phenomenon. And that was the reason that I invited them to my conference, because that's a perspective that I think is very important, and that's the reason I'm having Noe Torres and Ruben Uriarte speak this year on the Cowboys and Aliens topic, that this predates the early days, the first Europeans to come to this area were experiencing and seeing things even then.
All right. Harmony, very quickly, somewhere in the world, you're on the air with Travis.
Yep.
Hello.
Hi, Travis. Hi, Art. Can
okay.
you hear me?
You're too loud. Just back away a little bit and tell us where you're calling. Where are you calling from?
I'm ringing from New Zealand.
New Zealand. Okay.
From Nelson, New Zealand. And I had a couple of encounters in the very similar time period as what Travis is, where I looked on the net and I read some of his story. But I'll tell you the second one first, because I think it'll corroborate some of what he's saying. The second one was a visual that we had in 1978. It was some sort of a craft that came across the Pacific Ocean from the distance, about 100 miles, and it covered 100 miles in about 10 seconds, went directly over our heads, flashing strobe lights, red, white, yellow, and blue. It covered that distance in 10 seconds, didn't make a sound, and it was within a half a mile of us when it went over our heads. There's reports in Ludington, Michigan on the 28th of July that year, 1978. A lot of other people saw it as well, including quite a few people from the Coast Guard and the Sheriff's Department. So you can look at the NICAP org website for that.
Okay.
Anyway, that was a visual. The other one was around the same time in 1975. I was in Los Angeles, and I was being threatened by a biker. And instead of defending myself, I sat down in cross-legged position and closed my eyes, and I got hit by a tractor beam or something, and it was like a billion volts of electricity, knocked me down on the ground and shook me for a minute, almost like I was having a seizure.
You sure the biker didn't hit you, right?
Then it was over. Okay, it was over. No, the biker, they just stood there with their jaws dropped. They couldn't believe and they walked away. The whole situation just diffused at that point. So
well,
I've been a believer ever since
that
we are not alone. We are not alone. And most of the news we hear is BS.
Well, you're right about that. All right, I'm sorry. We've got a break here, so everybody hold tight for a moment. Travis Walton is my guest. This is Midnight in the Desert, Raging in the Night from the High Desert.
Can be explored on Midnight in the Desert with Art Bell. If using Skype from your computer, please be sure to use a headset mic and call MITD51. That's MITD51.
That's the way it's done. If you're outside North America, it's MITD55. MITD55. And of course, on Skype, it's free. Travis Walton is here, and here he is once again. Okay, Travis, sort of a short time between breaks on this one. So, Nayan, is that correct?
Nayan.
Nayan, sorry.
Yeah, my name's actually Nathan. It was a made-up video game name.
Okay. Where are you?
Appreciate you taking my call, by the way, Art. Sure. Me and my brother are big fans.
Right.
You caused us a lot of sleepless nights in a good way, you know.
Oh, thank you, Roger.
Where are you? My question was...
I can't get that out.
Like, do you think the ETs that you saw are kind of like, you know, like a like robots or biologically programmed, like if we see an anthill, we see in cameras down there, or, you know what I mean? Do you think they're like a way to communicate, a bridge? Like if they're like fourth dimensional beings, you know, do you think that's a way they communicate with us?
Well, you know, using Occam's razor, I see that no necessity for that. If an advanced civilization could create a being that could stand in for an organic being to resemble in every way a living, breathing thing, it would be undetectable. So there would have been no way that I could have seen such a creation. But I also don't see the necessity of it. I think with their kind of technology, it's not that big of a leap to come here. It's just that they're being very circumspect respect for our level of development.
What did the ship look like?
All right, we'll get to that. Where are you calling from? I want to get to that.
Oklahoma.
Oklahoma, all right. So, yes, as best you can, describe, I guess, the shape. You've sort of already done that, but for him, if you would.
Well, a metallic disc with a dome on top, glowing areas with non-glowing areas that are more like some kind of a more rigid part of the structure. I don't know the nature of why some of it was glowing. It didn't feel hot. I was close enough that I think that if it was glowing because of a high temperature, that I would have been able to feel the heat, and I didn't feel heat.
Would you roughly describe it as a flying saucer?
Yes, like two pie pans put lip to lip, kind of angular. But the craft that I was returned from was more rounded, but again, still a disc shape. I'm thinking that something to do with the propulsion requires a generally circular dimension.
A lot of people are sending in questions on the computer asking if you have had any experience or contact since.
That's a very common question, and I always tell them, if I did, I wouldn't tell anybody, because I stick to what I can document. I did talk about that giant black triangle, because I had two witnesses with me, and then went online and found that there was a dozen more.
Mm-hmm. I think you're doing a wise thing, because if you had another experience and laid that out for everybody, you're absolutely right. It would detract from your credibility, no matter how true it might be.
Exactly.
So, very, very interesting.
But that's the nature of the beast.
It is indeed. Glad you know that. Wilmington, North Carolina. Hello.
Hi, Art. This is Gabrielle of Eastern Paranormal. I'll ask my question, and then I'll jump off the air to listen. I just wanted to know Travis's thoughts on God before his abduction versus after his abduction. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. So did you find God with the aliens?
No, I found God prior to that. I believe that if you truly understand infinity in terms of time and distance, both future and past, then God is a certainty.
You were...
I'll leave it at that.
Okay, in Snowflake, you were a church-going person, yes?
Not a regular. I was an irregular, and that kind of put me on the edge of this devout community. But I see nothing about the presence of alien beings in this galaxy, in this universe, as in any way contradicting any religious principle.
You do understand, though, that for some people, that would
be... They see it as a contradiction.
Yes,
yes. Yeah, I've encountered that in ways that harmed relationships. My son was a girlfriend, was advised to get away from him
Wow.
By the local Catholic priest brought in a guy that, you know, said his dad is consorting with demons. And it wasn't so long after that that the Vatican came out and said, no, there is absolutely nothing evil about believing that there are beings out there on other planets. And right. So people who, you know, say, well, if it's not in the Bible, it doesn't exist, are really pretty small-minded, in my view. They're selling God short. There's nothing in the Bible about Native Americans, and yet they exist.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing in the Bible about Antarctica, but it exists. So, you know, the idea that if it's not in the Bible, it's not true is a little bit narrow-minded, in my view.
Very quickly, Jonathan on Skype.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Mr. Bell and Mr. Walton, very nice to meet you both.
Thank you.
I'm Matthew. This is Jonathan's brother.
All right.
I have a couple of questions.
Real quick.
Please explain in very detail what the alien looks like. The grays?
Okay.
In great detail, like their appendages.
Feet, okay.
Do they have irises? The color of their irises? Clothing? Things like that.
Okay.
Yeah, they did have irises. They did not have a black obsidian-like eye. I speculate that might be some sort of a sunglass sort of eye protective covering, similar to sunglasses, because every creature that has oversized eyes on Earth live in a very dark environment. They're either nocturnal, live in a cave, or you know, under the sea at great depths. So huge eyes imply low light. So, you know, the idea that they would cover it with some sort of a dark thing.
All right, we're at break. So think about it during the break, and we'll talk more about what they look like when we come back.
For Dark Matter News, I'm Leo Ashcraft. Is our universe a fake, an elaborate computer simulation? Philosopher Nick Bostrom, director of the Future of Humanity Institute of Oxford University, describes a fake universe as a richly detailed software simulation of people, including their historical predecessors. He says this fake universe was created by a very technologically advanced civilization. David Wren, sci-fi writer and space scientist, relates the Chinese parable of an emperor dreaming that he was a butterfly, dreaming that he was an emperor. In contemporary versions, Wren said it may be the year 2050, and people are living in a computer simulation of what life was like in the early 21st century. Or it may be billions of years from now, and people are in the simulation of what primitive plants and people were once like. David said he began bemused. The notion that humanity might be living in an artificial reality, a simulated universe, seemed sophomoric, at best science fiction. But speaking with scientists and philosophers on Closer to the Truth, he says he realizes that the notion that everything humans see and know is a gigantic computer game of sorts, the creation of super smart hackers existing somewhere else, is not a joke. Exploring a whole world simulation, he says he discovered, is a deep probe of reality. Check out the video from Closer to the Truth at darkmatternews.com and also artbell.com. Remember yesterday when NASA's Mars Curiosity rover took a photo that really looked like an alien crab monster on the surface of the red planet? Well, now they've gone one better. A new closer photo appears to show a ghost woman on Mars. It really does kind of look like a ghost woman. Take a look at the photos on artbell.com and let us know what you see. The HAARP Project in Alaska, the subject of many conspiracy theories, is being blamed by some in Moscow for the failure of the wheat crop and the smoke that has been choking the city in recent weeks. The Russian government said it will suspend wheat exports until December because of the severe drought that has hit much of the country. Moscow's tabloid press has even speculated that the United States orchestrated the heat wave in order to favor its own grain exporters by blasting Russia with harmful rays from a research station in Alaska known as HAARP. But the paranoia goes beyond the comments of some newspaper editors.
Andrei Ereshev, the deputy director of the Strategic Culture Foundation, said the real purpose of the high-frequency active oral research project in Alaska is to build a weapon in order to destabilize environmental and agricultural systems in local countries. At the moment, climate weapons may be reaching their target capacity and may be used to provoke droughts, erase crops, and induce various anomalous phenomena in certain countries. These harsh words were published in an article written by Andre. The article has been carried by publications throughout Russia, including International Affairs. As far as weather control goes, HARP states on its website that its transmitter and array of 180 antennas has no impact on that part of the atmosphere. They say transmitted energy in the frequency ranges that will be used by HARP is not absorbed in either the ionosphere or the stratosphere, the two levels of the atmosphere that produce the Earth's weather. But Russia isn't alone placing blame on the United States HARP project. Iran has also recently blamed the U.S. HARP project for the recent heat wave permeating the country this summer. Othana Zuck, an Air Force spokesman, said HARP is scheduled to be handed over on August 11th to the University of Alaska. A ceremony for the handover is also scheduled to take place later this month. That agreement allows access for 2 years, which will provide the university and the Air Force time to negotiate an agreement regarding the transfer of the land. They say the facility has been dormant this summer and don't expect to be operational until next spring because of Alaska's harsh winter. Russia and Italy, on the other hand, don't believe a word of that. I'm Leo Ashcraft for Dark Matter News.
I was a highwayman. Along the coach roads I did ride, with sword and pistol by my side. Many a young maid lost her baubles to my trade. Many a soldier shed his lifeblood on my blade. The bastards hung me in the spring of 25, but I am still alive.
I was a sailor, I was born upon the tide. With the sea I did abide. I sailed a schooner around the Horn of Mexico.
In that darkest time, between dusk and dawn, from the high desert, it's Art Bell's Midnight in the Desert. Now, here's Art.
Here I am. Travis Walton is here. Listen to me. I've got an announcement I want to make because I've been struggling and struggling and struggling with this. So I've received a communication from a time traveler. I consider this communication to be legitimate. And I've been trying to figure out what in the world to do. He gave me a code word so I would recognize this person when he calls. What I'm going to do is the following. So I want everybody to cooperate. You can make your own judgments if you wish. But I think this is the real thing. So I am going to have, when I get done with the show, perhaps in an hour or two, I'm going to send this very long email to Keith, and I'm going to have him post it. I'm going to eliminate the code word he gave me so I would recognize him when he calls. Beyond that, I'm going to post it. So those of you over the weekend will have an opportunity at your leisure to read it and make your own decision. I received it yesterday, and I've been really, really, really struggling with how to approach this, and I think this is the right way to do it. So by tomorrow morning, no later than tomorrow morning, and probably tonight, if Keith can do it, he will post this email. It's going to take you a while to read, but I think we have a legitimate source here, just like we've got a legitimate guy on the line right now, Travis Walton. Travis, again, your documentary, Travis, it's got the newer stuff in it, right?
Yes.
So if they want to catch up on your real experience, and it is real, whether they like, you know, have you noticed, Travis, that some people react to an experience like yours with anger?
Yeah, I've experienced that. and, you know, a sort of a desperate need to just latch on to anything to help them dismiss it for some reason.
That's right. That's exactly right. Many of my programs have been met with the same kind of anger, and I always... I guess it's fear-based. I'm not really sure.
It is fear-based. And some of the most, the blasts that I get every, you know, year and a half, 2 years from somebody online,
right.
You know, I say, look, don't be afraid. It's not going to happen to you. And you would not believe how often that turns them around and they're apologetic. And, you know, the extreme reaction is just fear-based.
All right, let's go to Thornhill, Ontario, I think it is. Hello.
Oh, it's Michael from Toronto, Canada.
Okay. I'm sorry, it says Thornhill.
That's right. I'm right on the border, 10-minute walk
away. Okay.
I have a question for your guest, Travis, and for you, Art, and for your whole audience.
Sure.
I'm with MUFON Canada. I've had an experience with a UFO and very similar to what the crew seen as what was described as streaking away. And what I'm asking about is the light. I'm actually very, very interested in the type of light. I don't believe it's normal light. Travis has already answered one of my questions when he said that the light was actually shining through the trees and onto the road. I've had an experience and met other people that say, yes, they've seen a bright light, but it did not affect the area. My question is, sir, to both of you and to your audience, has anybody or does anybody know about such a thing where a light is there but does not affect the atmosphere around it?
Hmm. Well, I think, okay, Travis. For you.
Well, you know, it lit up the area with a very strange sort of a ethereal kind of a glow. It was a very soft light, and but it was still visible from back down the road.
Right.
The reason it was washing across the road at that point was because there was a break in the trees. But it was a very strange light that made the foliage and surroundings look very odd.
All right. Before the break, the caller asked for the best description of the alien creatures that you could give. In other words, hands, legs, digits, fingers, color of eyes, anything you can come up with at all.
Well, the hands had a normal number of digits and were, you know, looked like four fingers and a thumb. Extended towards me, they wow. seemed to lack fingernails and creases at the bend points. Now, there is a possibility that that was actually a surgical glove, you know, but that was the way the hands looked to me, that were extended towards me. If they were in the midst of medical-type procedures, mm-hmm. Perhaps they were wearing gloves. Now, as far as the eyes are concerned, now that's the reason I say, you know, people that are lumping them together as grays. The ones I saw had a pupil, an iris, and lids, eyelids that blinked. No eyelashes, but definitely... a very large iris, a very large pupil. Even in that dim lighting, the pupil was fairly constricted.
Almond shape, as we see depicted?
No, there wasn't a huge slant to the eye. But, you know, I really do think that a lot of these descriptions are accurate. They just are different beings that just happen to look that way. I think it might be common that either the daytime radiation on the planet they're from is so intense that they're nocturnal, or the atmosphere is so thick that not a whole lot mm-hmm. of light reaches during their daylight hours.
Right. You know, your story in totality to me sounds like you were the accidental abductee. In other words...
That's my favorite theory now.
Really?
yeah, you know, Alan and Steve and some of, I think Kenny, you know, they think it was all a plan, like they were laying for us. But I don't know. I did something very unexpected.
Yes, indeed. Some might say stupid. I mean,
I say I felt like this was my own irrational impulse. They say, well, if they can control you, they can make you think it's your idea.
Here.
And I guess they got a point there, too.
Claude, you're on the air with Travis Walton.
Well, thank you, Art and Travis. It's a great show tonight.
Thank you.
I can just tell you one thing, Travis, is that if people who have never seen a UFO themselves are going to be deniers. But as for myself, the UFO I saw, or should I say UFOs, two of them, were no more than 50 and six or 60 feet away from me in my backyard of my house in Gurley, Alabama. So I pretty much believe what you're telling me.
Yeah, once you've seen, it changes your life. Simple as that.
Yeah.
All right.
I have a little saying. For those who have seen them, no more evidence is necessary.
It's true.
For those who have never seen it and don't want to believe, no amount of proof will ever be enough.
That's right. That's exactly right. Okay, we've got somebody calling named AA on Skype. AA, hello.
Hi, Art.
Yes.
I got a question for...
Travis.
For you and Travis. Oh, thank you.
Okay.
I was wondering if you would have Clyde Lewis on sometime, and Travis, to you. I was wondering if they spoke to you telepathically.
I think they were attempting to do so, and it wasn't working because of the brain injury. Now, brainwave scan, the EEG I underwent, was at a very, very prestigious brain trauma center, the Barrows Neurological Institute. It's world famous. And I was put in under an assumed name, which made the test double blind. The technician did not know the nature of my injury. He was just told to look for injury, and he found it. So that brainwave pattern, that report, those scans are going to be reinterpreted with some new neuroscientists, and hopefully a follow-up to see if there's any remaining evidence of that pattern.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you both.
Right. Thank you very much for the call. Let's see. You actually touched one of them, and somebody wants to know, again, through the wormhole, if you can describe what their skin felt like.
Well, it was really just the back of my arm. It was a kind of a sweeping sort of knocking them away kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they were... it wasn't against their skin. It was against the chest.
Right.
And he or it fell back very easily. It was much lighter and softer than I expected.
Okay. Let's see. You're on the air on the phone line. Don't know where you are, but you're on the air.
Montreal, Canada.
Okay. Excellent.
I'm going to ask a quick question. There's been many reports of people who've been abducted who come back in pieces or not at all. That's my first question. Second question, how have your psychic abilities been enhanced by this contact? Afterwards, have they contacted you again psychically?
Mm-hmm.
I'll listen off the air.
Okay, well, I think that we would acknowledge your first statement about people, some of them coming back in pieces or not at all. And I think for the second part of your call, I don't think he's going to answer that, but...
You got it.
I didn't think you were. On to another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Art?
Yes, sir.
Okay, yeah. Question for Travis?
Right.
Can I speak it now?
Yes, you can speak it now. He's right here.
Yeah. If you could describe what the jumpsuits looked like and if there was any type of identifying patches or anything like that on it, and then secondly, with the human-type person you saw... Did that look like any type of a terrestrial type of a spacesuit, or was it something that was just something beyond what we have here on Earth?
All right.
All right. First, my apologies to the previous caller that, you know, I'm just sticking to what I can document. As far as the suits, it was just a sort of a loose, billowy soft material, a coverall. I wouldn't call it a spacesuit at all. It was just clothing. They were alike. It was a orangish brown under that lighting. That's the way it looked to me. And the human-looking individual, it was, again, much more close-fitting over the, you know, it wasn't like a leotard, but it was closer-fitting. Just a blue, sort of a velour or soft, weaveless sort of a fabric. And no, there were no insignia of rank or, you know, origin at all.
All right. Several people wanting to confirm, you were taken aboard one craft and returned to Earth or returned to the ground, whatever the case may be, on a second craft, in your opinion.
Right, yeah, of a different configuration. The more rounded, more polished one is the one that brought me back. And I did see two, possibly three of those in that big hangar-like structure.
Wow.
Whether it was a larger craft or a building. He was pulling me along pretty rapidly. I was having a lot of trouble just keeping my footing, and he was in quite a bit of hurry, and it might have been for my own benefit that there was, it was kind of a medical emergency.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than trying to keep me from seeing too much.
Got it. All right, we're coming toward the end. Sushi Dog or somebody like that, you're on Skype and on the air.
Hi, hello. Art.
Yes, hello. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is for Travis. I'm curious about food and drink. From what I understand, he was gone for 5 days.
That's right.
When was the last time he had anything to eat or drink prior to the abduction? And B, has he ever thought about how he was sustained for 5 days?
Awfully good questions. Travis?
Yeah, good question. I've heard it before. Obviously, I've been a lot of years. Since I was only conscious for that brief, you know, hysterical period of time, I obviously wasn't sitting down to a meal. However, medical tests did show that there had to have been some kind of nourishment, according to, you know, their indicators, which is the presence of something they call ketones, which is a sign that you've been breaking down your own body stores to stay alive. And that was absent. But
and they would have tested you for dehydration, of course.
Yeah, and there was considerable dehydration, so they were either underestimating my fluid requirements or had another reason to minimize that as part of my treatment or something. But other than being somewhat dehydrated, and the evidence for that was the 10 or 11 pound weight loss.
Wow.
Very quickly recovered just by slaking my thirst, which was pretty intense.
My goodness.
You know, whatever means of sustenance or, for that matter, using the restroom, you know, I don't have any memory of those that other part. Whether I was in a coma the entire time or under anesthesia the whole time, I don't know. But probably had at least some conscious period. I don't know if I was fed during that time or not, but... you know, after this many years, without recalling more of those memories, I really doubt it'll ever come back to me.
All right. Let's do it quickly. The documentary, simply called Travis, is available on your website. Or where else was it?
TravisWalton.com or On Wings. And the Wings with a G-E-S on the end. On Wings Productions.
And you've got a conference coming up, a conference called Sky Fire Summit. And it's Sky.
Yes, that's the website, skyfiresummit.com.
Okay, so they can, I guess, get tickets or join you there. Nothing like seeing somebody really in the flesh. Well, Travis, it's been a long time since we talked. Thank you so much for coming on the program.
Great to be with you again. Great show. I love the bumper music. The whole show is great.
Thank you, my friend. Good night.
Good night.
All right. I'm going to do that. I'm going to get this email that I mentioned posted on the at artbell.com. So don't look for it immediately. I'm going to have to get back there, get it to Keith. It's going to take some doing to get it posted. But I want you to digest this over the weekend. It's really something, let me tell you. Really something. Email from a time traveler, and it's a serious one. Good night, everybody. Have a great weekend. I'm Art Bell. To the world, all of you, have a great one.
Are we lost our intuition? Are we running out of time?